Blog Talk Radio.
You listen to The Unknown Show. I'm your host, Bud Smith. And I have a lot of readers, a lot of stuff going on tonight. Tonight. This is The Unknown Show. I'm Bud Smith. We have a bunch of shit going on tonight. A bunch of people calling in. I'll rattle off what you can expect. Neat Tower is supposed to call in. He's going to read us a story. He's recently had a short story published in Matt Garucki of Drunk Monkeys. Has an anthology out. I believe they're both coming on. They'll shoot some shit with us. And some random other people reached out to me about calling in the show today. We'll see who's gonna make the time for it. You know, it's Tuesday night. I got a lot of shit going on. I'm sure everybody does. to open the show up, though, I wanted to talk about a book that just came out that struck my interest. The book is Random Acts of Terror, and it's out by Lewis Rivas. He's a columnist at Red Fez, and he's got a bunch of stuff going on. His book is out from Citizens for Decent Literature. If you go to theliteraryunderground.org, you'll see a write-up about his book, Random Acts of Terror. It's poems, chapbook poems, and it looks really cool. I got an email here with a few of the poems from it. I wanted to read a couple because they looked really great. And I'm going to pick it up myself as soon as I... okay, so here we go. I want to read a couple poems from Lewis Rivas' book, Random Acts of Terror, okay? This one here opens up with a quote in Spanish, which I can barely speak English. So I'm going to skip that. The Day the Immigrants Took Over by Lewis Rivas. They were mopping up the floor in all the buildings in downtown L.A. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest, getting it ready for buffing. They were emptying out all the office trash cans into bigger trash cans, wiping down the glass doors and windows with the luxurious, bold, silver, gold, or black letters that read Executive, CEO, CFO, President, Vice President, and Board Members. Some were sweeping, wiping down countertop in expensive homes in Mulholland Drive, Hollywood, and Woodland Hills, wearing bright yellow rubber gloves. Some drove drunk, got into accidents, and got arrested. Some restocked the shelves at liquor stores or swap meet boutiques. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest counted the current stock, documenting nightly inventory, only to be accused of stealing first thing in the morning by the owner, another immigrant. They were all immigrants, mostly illegal. Some were only illegal residents, but no citizenship in the process. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest. They would answer to authority figures or better off, friends and lawyers, always in the process, citizenship pending dues, legal fees, lawyer expenses, pending the review of potential criminal records, pending, always pending. Then the raids became more frequent and severe. First at the liquor stores or swap meet boutiques, downtown L.A. buildings, the expensive homes they cleaned. Then at convenience stores where they would shop for groceries. They were arrested, convicted of a felony, fined, jailed to burn off time, but stayed accused. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest of owing and finally deporting. So one day they organized. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest began reading up on economy, history, political theory, philosophy, and military tactics. They were doing push-ups, sit-ups, and pull-ups in jail, counting out loud in Spanish, glancing over at the roaches crawling on the beige cold floor, noticing the vast majority of their imprisoned neighbors were also immigrants, all in unison reciting, "All wars in history have been struggles between the ruling class and the marginalized." They placed the improvised explosive devices in all the rooms with the glass doors. They placed all the improvised explosive devices in all the rooms with the glass doors with the bold silver, gold, or black letterings that read executives, CEO, CFO, president, vice president, and board members. They worked in shifts watching from the rooftops of neighborhood buildings with gallons of diesel fuel, dry rags, and lighters. They waited patiently in the bushes of those same expensive, isolated, multi-story houses on hills built on stilts. They waited in favor of the houses and the houses of the mayor, the governor, the congressman. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest waited. And then almost all at once they began. And the police and press arrived almost immediately. Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest concealing their identity with red rags covering their entire face, except for their brown piercing eyes, made identical statements saying, "Hermanos, elected representatives, we are the immigrants of your nation, and you have declared war on us, so we are acting in defense. Implement reformative democratic policies and legislature, or we shall have to act defensively in an undemocratic fashion. If you continue to bring repression on us, we shall return it back tenfold. We do not fear death. We are Pedro, Maria, Juan, Jose, and the rest. We come from the place where there is no peace, where the heads of our organizers hang on trees, blowing in the wind like ripe fruits, where there are no jobs, no schools, no hospitals, no democracy, only churches, statues, and empty, dry, yellow fields, where once were farms and homes. We come from war. We are unafraid of it. We give you this only choice. Give us peace or we'll give you war." That's something else right there. All right, I'm going to read another one. This is called Poetry is Borgios. Okay, first, I would just like to apologize for writing this, for writing a love poem. You know, I don't normally do this, write love poems, let alone to dead German women, but there has been sufficient amount of work written in your tribute, in your honor. An unaffected, tormented creator of rebellion, literary and actually Erlich Meinroth, with dark, hurt, mothering eyes. She who embraced the clandestine, a mother, a journalist, a fighter, a revolutionary that transcended her immortality, as we all must, in the righteous cause against capitalism and imperialism. She who denounced the myth of objectivity that pollinates the world of journalism, neutrality which is fetishized into grandeur, that perpetuates in action, callousness, well-measured treachery, criminality of apathy. She who stopped writing in the professional sense, understanding the violence of textual silence, and rose up with Red Army faction comrades, who acted not from choice, but of historical obligation, as we all must. She who understood that destruction begets destruction, but violence begets resistance. And for her, I would abandon my stance against monogamy. And for her, I would rethink my stance on domestic relationships. And for her, I would loosen my dogma on the idea of marriage, historically a method for subjugation of women and perpetuation mechanism of capitalism. And for her, I would fall with wide open arms in ideological abandon, suspend my radical politics on marriage, relationships, and just worship her with my unequal, flawed, incomplete, infertile, revisionist love, and get on one knee, confess to her virtuous affection. But she would demand that I get up, look her straight in the eye, as equals. All convenience and mannerisms aside, and she would say to me, comrade, to hell with all that. You are my equal. Do not attempt to control yourself as a way to pay homage to me. Nothing is sacred. You struggle alongside me. That's all. Everything else is subjugated. Naturally, she would turn down my reactionary offer and say, I have one thing to ask. Stop writing, start acting, poetry is bourgeois. And I would take out my rejection on all future partners, incomparable measure them to Earl Reich, a rejection that I would never recover from a German woman, now 37 years dead, with cold, unfeeling doctors slicing up her brain, still trying to figure out her revolutionary commitment, what they mistakenly term as madness, sickness, which we can all equate repulsion for the world, appropriately measured reaction to it, proportionally anger, indignation, but above all things only, love, love, all things love. So those were two poems by Lewis Rivas. Check out his book, Random Acts of Terror, if you like those poems. I know I did. So let's see. All right, we have a couple people on hold here. I'm going to take a caller. Let's see who it is. Hello, you're on the air. Who's calling?
Hey, this is Nate Tower here. How you doing, bud?
Hey, great. What's up, Nate? How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I really enjoyed those two poems you just read.
Yeah, that guy's a fucking badass, huh?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check out that collection there.
Yeah, it's you can pick it up through literaryunderground.org, and if you know Michelle McDonald, she's responsible for that book. Reach out to her if you know her personally. So So what's going on in your neck of the woods?
Oh. Allergies, that's what's going on here.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's cool. So I guess recently you had a story published in the Drunk Monkeys anthology.
Right, I did, and I was really excited that Matt picked this one up, because actually this was a story that as soon as I started writing it, I thought, man, this is a Drunk Monkey story right here. This is perfect for Drunk Monkeys. And then when he responded and told me how much he liked it, I was really stoked about that and glad to see that he put it out in that collection, which is a pretty incredible collection. Haven't made it all the way through yet, but a lot of good stuff in this, and really pleased to see what Matt's put out here.
Yeah, he's a cool dude, man. Matt's a cool guy, man. He's met him in L.A. Actually, that's where the poet I was just reading, he hails from Los Angeles, too. Is, man, what a cool town to party in. You ever made it out that way?
I haven't made it out to L.A. before, no.
No?
No.
I've been there a couple times. It's always a fun time. I'm going to wind up going out to Beast Crawl in Oakland, which is like something Paul Corman Roberts runs. It's like a poetry bar crawl. Always looking for an excuse to go out to California, man. What a fun time it is out there.
Yeah, I've only been there once, and that was to San Diego, which is a beautiful city. I'd love to go back.
Yeah, San Diego's cool. Gets a little boring there. There's
I'd imagine so.
Yeah. So hey, man, can I get you to hold on a second? I got another call. I'm suspicious that it might be Matt. Let me see if I can get you guys both on the air.
All right,
Matt, is this you?
Hey, am I on?
Yeah. What am I talking to?
This is Bugace.
Who is this?
Bogace.
Oh, Bogace. How you doing, man?
Hi, yeah, this is Bogace. I was just calling because I'd actually heard, I'm good friends with Lewis, and I've just actually heard my name mentioned in that poem that you read.
I didn't know
he was writing about me. I kind of wish he would have changed my name.
No, I think I pronounced it wrong.
Bogace?
Yeah. Bogace. You want your money back or something?
No, I don't. No, man. You don't have to, you know. I didn't put any money into it at all. I'm not even sure, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know was there a mistake, do you think? I think he should have checked with me first. I mean, that's the only thing. That's the.
Do you have
I mean, is that ethical to, like, you know, to publish poetry or stories or whatever with real names in it?
I think so. I mean, I just wrote a short story about John Wayne.
Yeah, but he's deceased, man. I'm like a real living friend of Luis Rivas's, and, well, actually, till today I thought I was his friend, and, you know, it's one thing if you're writing about dead people, but I'm talking about, you know, like your friends and stuff. I mean, when you're sitting down and writing a story or a poem, I mean, do you use real names or you try to change them? I mean, he could have talked to me first.
I usually change the name.
You change the name?
Yeah, just a little bit, though. I might change a letter here or there, but that's it.
Yeah, but what's up with this guy? I mean, my name is blatantly in his work.
Huh. Very interesting. Well, I would advise you to reach out to Lewis and see if maybe perhaps he could offer some kind of condolence, you know?
Yeah, thank you. Is this thing already published?
Jesus, I think it is.
You got to be kidding me.
Well,
wow. Well, you know, I'm friends with him on Facebook and all that. I'm going to try to find him on there and see. I hope it hasn't been published. I mean, are you reading an actual copy of it?
No, I was reading the advanced. This is like an advanced screener publicist for Blurb. So, yeah, reach out to Lewis and best of luck to you. Thanks for calling in, okay?
Look, I'm sorry, but can you tell me who's publishing it?
All right. So anyway, so Nate, I was hoping I was going to be mad. It was not. Curious, are you in the mood to read that story?
I'd love to do it. You ready?
Yeah, man. I'm ready.
All right. I won't give any introduction other than the title.
Okay, cool.
All right, I'll try to get through this one. How long, so.
Sure, go for it, man. We got all the time in the world.
Here we go. The abortion party. Jared had to look at the invitation three times before he understood what it said. Even then, he wasn't quite sure he believed it. He brought it to his wife, Deborah, and asked what she thought. What the hell is a pregnancy termination party? He asked her. Oh, did we get Sherry's invite today? Deborah responded, reaching out in anticipation. Is this like an abortion shower or something? Sounds a little crude when you put it that way, she said. It's just a way of celebrating the reversal of an accident. Not everyone wants a kid, you know. You aren't seriously planning on attending this, are you? Of course I am. She's my friend. What do you bring for a gift, a bent coat hanger? Deborah gave me an icy stare. She's not a barbarian. It's not like this is some back alley procedure. This is a growing trend. If people can celebrate being pregnant, why can't they celebrate not being pregnant? So do you bring a gift? Jared asked. Of course. It is a party. She's registered at Bed Bath & Beyond. Jared glanced at the invitation again. Do they have a specific registry for this kind of thing? Don't be so dense. You can register for anything. Besides, you're being rude. She just wants to celebrate with her friends. He looked up from the postcard. Do I have to go? Your name's on the invitation, isn't it? So is this a couple shower? Well, they're both not having a baby, right? Jared shook his head and tossed the invitation on the table. I'm opposed to the whole idea. It's her body, Deborah defended her friend. That's not what I mean, Jared threw his hands up. You know I'm a fairly open-minded guy, but we're talking about celebrating nothing. We're not having a baby either right now, and you don't see us having a party for it. this is just a cheap ploy for gifts. But we didn't have to go through anything to not have the baby we're not having. They went through a lot. We can at least show our support. I think we should get the crystal set. Deborah pulled up the couple's registry on her iPhone and waved it in Jared's face. He stepped back to see the tiny screen. $75? You've got to be kidding. Deborah pulled back the phone and glanced at the small picture. Do you think that's too cheap? You know that's per piece, right? Should we get something else as well? Too cheap? I would think a $10 paper towel holder would be sufficient. He grabbed the phone from her hand and scrolled through the registry. This is insane. Everything on here is over $50. And what do they need all this junk for? Place settings for 12? It's not like they're adding anyone to the family. She grabbed the phone back. I'm ordering the crystal. I'm supporting my friend. And you're going to the party and you're going to put on a good face and be nice to everybody. Whatever, he said, before retreating to his home office to check his email and research pregnancy termination parties. After a few minutes, he gave up his search and opted for some lesbian porn. If these pregnancy termination parties really were popular, they were secretly popular. Not like lesbian porn. That was widely popular, which pleased Jared immensely. The party wasn't mentioned again until Deborah came downstairs one Saturday with a dress on. Where are you going in that? Jared asked. What do you mean? We've got Sherry's party to go to today. It starts in an hour. Why the hell are you wearing that stupid cut-off t-shirt? Jared thought Deborah looked sexy in the dress, although he hadn't noticed this until she started nagging him. He didn't bother to tell her, though. Deborah didn't seem to like it much when he told her she was sexy. Instead, he turned off the TV and went upstairs to put on what Deborah would consider proper public attire. Is this okay? He asked when he came down a few minutes later, wearing the nice jeans and orange polo she had picked out for him about a week ago, saying as she handed it to him, this would look great at a party. He figured that was some sort of hint. No, that's not okay, Deborah said before she even looked at Jared. You look like a bum. We're going to a special occasion, not a frat party. Jared looked down and shrugged. He thought he looked pretty good, even if he had been skeptical of the outfit when she had first presented it to him. Okay, I'll change. What do you want me to wear? You're not a child, Deborah said. You can pick out your own outfit. Just pick out something that isn't embarrassing. Jared decided he'd wear the same khakis and blue striped shirt he always wore when they went out anywhere. The good thing was they so seldom went anywhere that it was likely no one had seen him in the outfit, or at least no one would remember seeing him with it on. When he came back down a few minutes later, Deborah said, still not looking it. Do you have to wear that again? You wore that last time we saw Sherry. Jared put up a fight this time. I haven't seen Sherry since before she got pregnant. There's no way in hell she would remember what I was wearing. And if she did, then she's superficial, and I don't care what she thinks anyway. Does that mean I'm superficial and you don't care what I think? Of course not. It's your job to make sure I look okay. You need to notice what I'm wearing. But Sherry doesn't have any business criticizing my wardrobe, especially not in her condition. And just what is that supposed to mean? Her hands were suddenly on her hips. Jared felt sweat droplets slide down his armpits. I'll go change, he said, one more outfit on his mind. When he returned a few minutes later in the same khakis and the orange polo he tried before, Deborah told him it was time to go. She didn't bother to say anything about how he looked, and he wasn't sure if she noticed that all he'd done was mix the two outfits. He wondered if he could have come down in a clown suit with a giant dildo growing out of his forehead. Maybe she had a two-nag limit on clothing choices. Whatever the case, Jared was just glad they were getting on their way, although he was still pissed off about the whole thing. But that was okay with him because he had a plan. Hiding his devious smile, he hopped into the car and headed for Sherry's party with his silent wife seated next to him, a stack of perfectly wrapped presents in her lap. How many presents did you get her? He asked after they traveled a few miles. You mean we, she replied. Okay, fine. How many presents did we get her? They aren't just for her, you know. They're for her husband, too. Of course they are. I forgot they both weren't having this baby. He waited for her to tell him what gifts they were bringing. After three blocks of silence, he spoke again. So I'm still unsure of this whole thing. Do they actually perform the abortion there? No. Don't be an ignorant ass. Of course they don't. They aren't barbarians. This isn't some sort of animalistic ritual sacrifice to some crop gods. Sherry went to the doctor yesterday. It should be taken care of. How do you know? Have you ever been to one of these before? He glanced at her, but she didn't return his glance. No, I've never been to one. I'm just sure they don't do it at the party. That's a private thing, after all. Have you ever been to a baby shower where the baby is birthed? Jared shook his head. I don't get why we're celebrating. I'm not opposed to a woman's right to choose, but I don't see why anyone would go around announcing this choice. It wasn't just her choice, you know, Deborah said while shifting the gifts in her lap. They both made the decision. Sherry said it was more Adam's decision than hers. Some married couples actually make decisions together, you know. Jared glanced at her quickly, but her eyes were still glued to the road, ready to correct his slightest driving error. Of course, he said. I know that. I also hear that some wives don't nag their husbands about every little thing. Yeah, I've heard that too, and I've also heard the one about the husband who wasn't a complete dumbass. The snarky back and forth was making Jared a little horny, but he knew it wouldn't be right to proposition his wife for sex on the way to a party that celebrated the lack of procreation. Maybe the feeling would still be there when they got home that night, or maybe he could just jerk off in the bathroom at Sherry's party. He snickered the idea of getting semen on the toilet seat and Sherry getting pregnant as a result, even though it was just one of those silly urban legends. He couldn't help but laugh out loud at the thought. What the hell are you laughing at? Deborah asked when Jared's snickering sent a stream of spit flying to the windshield. Nothing, Jared said. Just thinking about some joke I heard at work. Well, keep it to yourself. I don't want you ruining the party with any stupid joke. Jared laughed for a few more seconds, and then the couple drove down the rest of the way to the party in silence. Okay, we're here, Deborah said, announcing the obvious when Jared parked the car and turned off the engine. Now remember to be nice. They've been through a lot. I thought they were celebrating. Well, yeah, but it's not like they won something. But I thought... Never mind what you thought. Let's just get inside and get this party started. Her voice rose in excitement. Jared tilted his head and stared at her in bewilderment, half expecting her to rip off her bra and twirl around overhead. Is this supposed to be fun or something? He asked as they walked to the porch. Of course it is, Deborah said. It's a party. There's going to be presents and games and... Are we going to play Pin the Dead Fetus in the Womb? Jared asked. Deborah punched him on the shoulder, the pile of presents slipping out of her hands and spilling onto the sidewalk. Look what you did, Jared said before Deborah could blame him. The wrapping paper's wrinkled now. And look at that bow in disarray. We can't present these presents. Jared laughed especially hard at his last line. Deborah punched him again and told him to pick them up. You better not embarrass me, she said, accompanying her words with her best death stare. Jared didn't die. Too late, he said, pointing to the front door where Sherry and her husband were standing, ready to open the door and invite their guests inside. Or ready to collect their loot, Jared thought, as he bent down to pick up the gifts and help his wife save face. Congratulations, Jared shouted, his arms full of the gifts. I couldn't be happier for you. Deborah shot him a look. He apparently was over the top. Yes, Deborah said, we are indeed happy for you. Jared handed the happy, unexpected couple the gifts and waited for their thank yous to be delivered. They took the gifts like piranhas with greedy hands but said nothing. With mangled gifts in hand, Sherry and her husband welcomed the couple inside. You're the first ones here, Sherry declared in an honorific tone. You can have a seat in the hearth room until everyone else arrives. There's drinks waiting for you. Please use a coaster. Deborah smiled and led her husband into the hearth room. What the hell the hearth room? Jared asked when they sat down, looking around to see why it was so special. He didn't have a hearth room in his house, and he wondered why his room wasn't good enough for such a title. It's a room with a nice fireplace. Look how beautiful their fireplace is. She walked over to the fireplace and rubbed her hand along the bricks. Jared knew she didn't know what she was talking about, but he didn't bother to tell her what he knew. Oh, and don't be a jerk, she added after her inspection of the bricks seemed complete and satisfactory. What are you talking about? Your tone out there was obnoxious. You don't have to mock them. I wasn't mocking anyone. I was treating them like I would treat anyone else celebrating a momentous occasion. He looked around again. Where the hell are those drinks they were talking about? Over there, Deborah said, pointing to a big cooler. Jared rose from the couch and glanced in the cooler. Nothing but light beer. I'd rather drink piss, he muttered, and flopped back on the couch. No one's stopping you, she responded. You'd probably say I was embarrassing you. Well, it would be embarrassing if my husband started drinking piss in front of everybody at a party, she said, staring at the doorway. Well, this is one hell of a party. I wouldn't want to embarrass you at such a fine event. Before she could respond, Tony and Drake walked in, giggling, with their hands clasped tightly. They both wore plaid shirts and tight-colored pants. Jared cringed at their flamboyance. He didn't care that they were gay, but they could at least wear normal pants. Deborah, Jared, wonderful to see you, Drake shouted as he released Tony's hand and scuttled over to Deborah. He planted a kiss on each cheek and then turned and pretended to do the same to Jared. It's wonderful to see you, too, Deborah said. Jared rolled his eyes at her false enthusiasm. He knew she didn't think much of them. He was convinced she actually hated gay people. She at least was against gay marriage, a topic that didn't bother Jared. As long as it didn't affect his ability to do anything, it didn't matter to him. So aren't you just so happy for Sherry? Tony said to Jared, plopping down on the couch a little too close for Jared's comfort. Although Jared didn't want to, he made small talk with Tony for a few minutes, while the other guests filed into the room carrying various gift bags and bottles of liquor. The room buzzed with happiness as everyone gushed over how great Sherry looked. "Yeah, she looks great," Jared said, even though he didn't think she looked any better now than she ever had. He didn't know how far along she'd made it into the pregnancy, but surely not enough to gain any weight. Hell, he knew of a lot of women who lost weight during the first trimester. If anything, Sherry should look better now than she ever had before. Just when Jared didn't think he could take all the nonsense anymore, someone announced it was time for the gifts. Apparently, they were on a tight schedule. They had to make sure the gifts were all open and the cake and alcohol was all consumed before some big finale. "What's this finale?" Jared whispered to his wife, but she turned away from him with a terse shh. Jared figured she was still mad about the supposed scene he'd caused upon entry. He was sure he'd hear nothing but nagging about that for the next month. As much as Jared didn't want to be there, he was curious about what kind of gifts everyone had brought, and of course he wanted to know what the hell the big finale was all about. The first few gifts were pretty boring: a gift card for a massage, a pair of comfy slippers, a gym membership. Jared had no idea what to expect at such an event, but he figured the gifts would at least be fun. Soon enough, they were. Everyone watched in suspense as Sherry opened a long box and pulled out a silver-studded dildo. Jared's eyes popped at the sight of the massive phallus. It must have been over a foot long with the girth of a beer can. "What the hell is she supposed to do with that?" Jared whispered to some woman's husband sitting next to him on the couch. The husband shrugged and glanced at his wife. She shook her head, and the man said nothing in response to Jared. The man didn't even look at him again. For the next dozen or so gifts, the crowd really went wild, laughing and applauding the great gifts poured upon the happy couple. Most of the gifts seemed specifically for Sherry, although there was a mega box of condoms that was arguably just as much for the husband. "Maybe we wouldn't all be here if they'd just thought to wear condoms before," Jared muttered to no one in particular. No one bothered to pay attention, if they heard him at all. When all the gifts were finally opened, the cake was distributed and the liquor was poured. Everyone ate and drank in a hurry, and a sense of unease began to sweep through the room. Jared figured it was just the result of calorie counting and indigestion. Before the last bottle could be emptied, the doorbell rang. "He's here," someone said, followed by a few nervous oohs. One of the women rushed to the door while everyone else chugged the last of their drinks. When the woman returned a few minutes later, a man wearing a white coat and carrying a black briefcase followed her. The guy almost looked like a doctor, but he looked more like a medical school dropout than an accomplished doctor. "What's the doctor doing here?" Jared asked his wife, forming his fingers into air quotes on the word doctor. "What do you mean?" she asked. "Why is there a doctor here?" "Are you being serious?" "Yes. What the hell is going on? Do you need to examine her?" She stared at him, and he felt dumb for some reason unknown to him, which made him even dumber. "Well, what's the deal?" he asked when she didn't bother answering. "He's here to do the operation," she hissed. "Well, stop embarrassing me. Just shut up and watch." "Wait a minute. You said they didn't do it here." "Well, I lied. I knew you would object to the whole thing if I told you." "You're damn right I would have objected. You mean he's going to do the abortion right here in front of all of us?" Jared squealed. Whereas his previous remarks were wholly ignored by the crowd, everyone stared at him now, many with glares of disgust. Deborah slapped Jared on the shoulder. "What's the matter with you?" she yelled at him. Jared stood up. "What's the matter with me? I'm not the one celebrating a live abortion. How can you people intend to watch this?" The guests chattered their support for Sherry and their hatred for Jared. There were so many flapping voices that Jared couldn't really decipher a word. Amidst the drama, the doctor popped open his briefcase and took out some menacing tools. "I think this would be better without him here," the doctor said, while pointing a long, sharp instrument at Jared. "I don't plan to stay," Jared said as he began heading for the door. As he walked out, he could hear Deborah's apologies. "I'm so sorry. He's just backwards. He doesn't understand the way the world is today. And he's had a lot of stress at work. He doesn't mean it. Jared decided he couldn't listen to her rambling justifications any longer. He stopped and began shouting without turning around. "There's nothing wrong with my view of the world. You're the ones in the wrong." He swung around an outstretched finger, condemning all the guests in the sweeping gesture. "I don't care what you do in the privacy of the doctor's office, but to invite people to this is barbaric. It's like you're turning this into a human sacrifice." "I'm not sacrificing anything," Sherry said. "I'm actually liberating myself. I'm doing the opposite of sacrificing." "Go ahead and think that if you want," Jared said. "I have the right to think whatever I want, and I have the right to do whatever I want in my own home," Sherry said. "Somebody get this asshole out of here," the doctor said while observing his collection of tools once more. "No one needs to force me out. I'm out on my own." He looked at Deborah before he left. She was obviously mortified. "Don't expect to find me at home tonight," he said to her. "I can't be with anyone who involves herself in such a ridiculous event." Deborah began sobbing in her hands, and a group of women comforted her. "We really must do this," the doctor said. "I have several other parties to get to this afternoon." Jared spit on the floor and left. He cursed everyone all the way home and continued to let out his hateful strings of profanity on the drive home to pack his things.
Back home, Jared rushed through the house with a suitcase. As he gathered the few possessions he felt were worth keeping, he spotted a used pregnancy test in the trash can. Pointing out with shaking hands, he did his best to decipher the markings on the stick. It was negative. He sighed and slid to the floor. He wasn't sure what the hell he'd do if his wife was actually having the baby. Once he was able to stand, he said a little prayer of thanks that there was no baby on the way. He didn't want to have to deal with such an inconvenience, especially not at a time like this. All right,
oh, that was
the abortion out. Party there.
that was a pretty crazy story, man. That was awesome.
Yeah, hopefully I managed to offend about everybody out there.
Not the intent,
of course. I mean, you gotta see what's really going on, and I think, you know, sometimes people don't understand that the way the characters act in a story is not necessarily reflective of the way an author acts or the way an author thinks. More reflection on, you know, society and other things like that. But yeah, certainly the intent is not to offend anyone there.
Oh yeah, who cares anyway? Honestly, like you know, if you can offend somebody, that's great. You know, I don't know how many people are left in the world that can get offended by a short story. I don't think they're out there anymore. I think that ended in like the late 30s.
Oh, that's too bad then.
Yeah.
Well, then I got my work cut out for me. I think I better write something that might do that.
Yeah. Oh shit. So is that story part of? I heard you have a project going on. It's like nagging wives and upset husbands. What's that called? What's that project?
Yeah, nagging wives and foolish husbands. And actually, that story was not originally intended to go in that collection. I wrote that story after that collection was completed, but. That collection's still in the publication stages. It's supposed to come out with Martian Lit sometime this year. And probably I will end up adding that story. I think it would accompany it nicely. You obviously saw the nagging wife there and the foolish husband to top that off. Definitely both in there.
Yeah, that was all right in there. So, hey, there's another caller who's been on the line for like 15 minutes. So I'm going to pull them on. Maybe they want to comment on your story. Hold on a second.
Alright.
Hey, caller. Are you there?
Hey, bud.
Hey, who's this? Is this Dustin?
Hey, this is Matt Garucci.
Oh, Matt Garucci. You sound like my buddy Dustin Holland. You guys got very similar man voices.
Sure.
Yeah.
Very
so what are you up to, man?
In my voice. I don't know anything about Dustin, but I'm just listening, you know. Glad to hear the story, you know. I'm glad to hear Nate. And I definitely hope it offends people. I really do. Even though I don't think that was the intent. But, you know, or at least makes people think. You know, offending and making people think, it's the same thing, really.
Yeah, that's the deal.
Yeah. So, it's a good time.
So, what are you doing? You calling from L.A. tonight?
Yeah, here in North Hollywood. Although, I think in about a month, I might be out your way. Actually, might be in New York, so I'll have to drop by and say hi in person.
Yeah, when are you coming here?
I don't know exactly. It looks like maybe the end or the middle of next month. And it'll be my first time out to New York. I've never been. So I'm pretty
That's
excited.
Awesome.
So I'm hoping it comes together. I kind of don't want to jinx myself too much, but it's looking like it's pretty good. Yeah, I'm going to be out there. And,
cool shit, man.
And hopefully get to meet some of my East Coast writers because I work with so many people that are in Boston or New York or whatever, and you know, never get to have face time with them. So it'd be cool. So,
like for instance, who's out here? Who's out here that you're referring to? I mean, like
Donald McCarthy, who he has a piece in the anthology, and he writes.
Yeah.
He does Game of Thrones recaps for us right now, actually, which are pretty popular, I guess. I know he's in New York. I forget exactly which neighborhood he's in. I think it was the neighborhood that MTV did that show about, Washington Heights.
Oh, dude, he lives in my neighborhood then. That's where I live.
Oh, there you go. Okay, I think that was him, but I could be wrong about that. But I know he is definitely in New York. Nate Graziano is in New Hampshire, and he's kind of a Boston dude, sort of in heart.
Yeah.
And
I know Brian LeLay's up there too. You know him?
That's right. Yeah, Brian and Jess are up there as well. And Brian's interview with Kevin, Ridgway,
yes,
who's out here.
Yes, true, yeah.
He's one of the few California writers. That's in the anthology, too, which was great. Did you get to read that when that was on the site? Because that was so fucking in-depth, those two just going back and forth. It was really gorgeous. So I was really glad to be able to.
Both of those guys rock, man. Brian LeLay and Kevin Bridgefield. And you're referring to, for people who are just tuning in and who aren't totally aware of what you're talking about, we're talking to Matt Kuraki from Drunk Monkeys, and on the line, too, we have Nate Tower, story.
Hey, Nate, by the way, never got to speak to you before, so hey, what's up?
hey, Matt, how you doing? I want to say thanks for publishing that story. I'm really pleased to be in that collection that you put out there.
Oh, thanks. I was glad to be able to unleash that on the world. I mean, I read that, and it was such... I think you might have even sent that to me kind of... Was that the one you sent for me just for my opinion? And I said, fuck it, I need to publish this. Because it was...
Well, I know when I originally wrote it, I kept thinking, this is a Drunk Monkey story. This is for Matt. I got to send this to him. And I think maybe when I did send it to you the first time, I said, hey, what do you think of this? And
that might have been it.
I guess you liked it.
There was definitely one you did, and that was, I remember you saying there weren't a lot of takers on that particular story, but I loved it, so.
Yeah, I had at least one person said, no, this is way over the top, we can't touch this.
I don't know, it seems very subtle. I mean, yeah, I guess the story, the concept is over the top, but what I like about it is the way you kind of layer it in this kind of very... almost mundane, like this is just happening. This is like a bachelorette party or anything. I think my favorite part of the story is for the moment when the door rings and everyone kind of goes, ooh, like it's a stripper or something. And you realize it's the doctor, you know, it's just a nice turn, you know. So,
right.
Anyway,
yeah, and I agree. I think that the subject's over the top, but I never really envisioned anything written in there to be over the top.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, anyway. I'm glad we got it. But, yeah, whatever happened with the other editors, I'm glad we got it, and I'm glad it's in the collection. You know, that's all good.
Yeah, who knows? You know, with sending stories out, you never know what's going to wind up where, and who's going to be taking what. You know, it's a total shot in the dark, right?
That's true.
Sometimes it's just, you know, the editor didn't need that story at that time. You know, I mean, when I send my stuff out, you just never know what's really going to take with who. And I had a story about a month back that finally got published after sending it out to, you know, probably 10, 15 different places and it not clicking. And then suddenly the editor's like, it's perfect. Don't change your work. This is great, you know. And I got some really good notes from everyone else, but it just wasn't for them. But it was for this site. So I was glad to have it sort of in my original vision there, you know.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
I know.
So Matt, what are you been up to, Matt? You've been writing a great tale, or are you kind of like just a little consumed with putting the anthology together? What's been your main output these days?
Well, I'm getting back into writing sort of in the last couple weeks after I did spend probably about a solid month, you know, because I've been working on the anthology since the beginning of the year. But it was kind of like something I was kind of kicking down the road. Like, okay, I know I have to deal with this and kind of getting the art together and acknowledging that everyone else is okay with getting their stuff reprinted in it or published for the first time in it. And so there was so much busy work to do that I was like, well, I'll deal with it later. And then last month came, I was like, oh, wait, I have to fucking deal with it now. So I did it and got it done. And then once that was out and done and kind of, you know, now it is whatever it's going to be. Then I kind of switch focus back to writing, which has been really fun, actually, because that's more relaxing for me than the editing and the point-click of it all. Of getting
I hear you, man. I feel myself, too. Like, I like to write, but, you know, I've been putting books together recently, too. Doing, like, putting books together for Clefjaw, laying them out, and some titles came out. And William Seward Bonney just put out a really cool book of poetry. And I'm doing the layout and stuff on that and distracting them. Doing an anthology, the Virginia anthology that's coming out soon. Wrapping these things up is it's cool. Just getting back into the writing. It's a little more exciting, you know. So actually,
hey, congratulations, by the way.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I just got married the other day. Yeah. Thanks a lot. So, Matt, hey, listen, man, we got another caller. I'm going to pull him on the air, and maybe we'll see who's calling in. We'll say hello.
Yeah, right? But thanks for having me on. Thanks for having me on, and I'll
talk to you. Hey, stay on the line. You got time. 805, you're on. Who's this?
Hey, how's it going, boys?
Hey, who's this?
This is Claffy. Can you hear me okay?
Who's it?
James Claffy. Yeah.
Hey, James. What's up?
Oh, James, what's up, dude?
How you doing, guys?
Yeah, great. What are you up to?
Doing good.
I'm walking the dog and the baby in 80-degree heat.
No shit. You're,
listen to that story, Jesus.
Yeah.
Nice work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's something else, right?
What's that?
I said, Nate's something else, huh?
Oh yeah, that's some good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know where that was going.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, nicely done.
Hey, I'm glad you called in.
The baby didn't hear it, though, so that's thank God for that.
My wife would be very upset.
Jesus, yeah.
I was actually telling my wife last night, my new wife, I was sitting at the table, and, we were drunk, you know, but I'm sitting there at the table, and I'm telling her about my friend, you know, my friend who lives on an avocado farm, and she started laughing.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, oh, you're so full of shit. And I was like, no, really, I got a fucking friend who lives on an avocado farm. And, she's like, you're a fucking dumbass, you know. She's ready to divorce me already, but it's true.
Already, dude, that's quick. You know the story about avocado trees. They're actually down South America. Avocado is a corruption of it's like aguacate, and it means testicles. So they're testicle trees. So you know when you look at them, they look like big balls.
Yeah, that was the other thing. You didn't believe that they grow on trees.
Oh yeah, not like money, but they grow on trees, all right. Yeah,
that's fucking awesome. So man, you got a book coming out soon, don't you?
I do. Yeah.
What's the name of your book, and when's it coming out?
It's called Blood of Cold Blue.
Nice.
It's just a collection of stories, and Press 53 are bringing it out, which is great.
Yeah, damn right.
Yeah, I was very, very happy when they agreed to do that.
Oh,
I was
sweet,
like,
man.
You know, slaving away, you know, like the rest of us, you know, I'm just working away in the dark, just scratching on the words on the page, and like, what's the fucking point? And guess they liked it, so, you know, it just keeps us going for another day, another story.
Oh, fuck yeah. So let me ask you a question, man. Do you submit your manuscripts a lot? I know you're always pumping out short stories and stuff. Do you always kind of send your manuscripts out, or has it just been like a recent thing where like you're...
I had the collection of short fiction, and I sent it about 7 places.
Cool, man.
It was just out there waiting, and I kind of bugged Press 53 for an answer because somebody else was interested, and they said yes, so I said, okay, great. But,
awesome.
You know, the other stuff, you know, I have a novel that I've been sending out to agents, which is just, so miserable. You probably know, I mean, it's just, you know, most of the time you don't even get an email back. It's just, you know, the great silence.
Yeah, well, I think the great silence. I don't know what the story with that's ever going to be. It's just keep having fun.
Yeah, that's it. You just got to keep writing, and it's harder and harder every year. It's just difficult because they're looking for the big ball, the home run. They want something easy with a nice, you know, here's the plot, here's the story, here's the packaging.
Yeah.
You know, you can consume this without even thinking about it, and they don't have to work to do much to sell it. So, you know, when you're writing stuff that's not, you know, fully mainstream, it's rough, you know. You just have to stick with it, and it's, you know, it's all about perseverance, you know. We keep going back for more. Just, you know, reject me one more time, go on.
Yeah, it's like the, it's funny because like the flip side of that though is like times are so different now than they ever were. The great struggle to be published is it's past. I mean, you know, anyone can publish a book at any you can put a book out every day if you wanted to. But the thing
exactly,
is, really taking the time. I mean, you know, I noticed just in my short time of fucking around with this stuff, you know, self-publishing stuff, whatever. It is what it was, but teaming up with editors, copy editors, and really working on a script and doing rewrites and everything. Wow, what an experience that was! What a great thing! And I think that was what it was all about. So
yeah, it's a great experience. Yeah, my wife has just gone through it with CCLAP in Chicago. They're bringing her novella out this month, and
yeah,
I mean they've done such a lot of great work with her on the manuscript. I mean, more work than I think you'd probably see from a big house because they're just stretched too thin and they can't devote the time to the mechanics and the deep work that needs to be done. So they want stuff that's ready to go, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, these guys in Chicago have been great and they've done a super job with her book. It looks amazing.
That's awesome.
So if anyone's listening, they better buy it so that we can, you know, eat another avocado. We gotta water those suckers. There's no rain out here. Matt will tell you there's no rain in California.
Yeah. It's crazy hot this week. Yeah.
Oh Jesus, yeah. I mean yesterday, or was it Sunday? It was just blazing hot.
Yeah, I think it was yesterday, and I'm in North Hollywood. It was 103 in North Hollywood yesterday.
Yeah, brutal, brutal. Yeah, we were swimming in the ocean the first time this year. It was fabulous. Really was. Well, you're doing great work there, Nate. You're doing awesome work. I mean, Nate's work is awesome, and Matt's work is so great, and your book, bud, Jesus, I've been laughing myself silly out of it.
Yeah.
I've been reading the toll booth and cracking up.
Oh yeah, that's right, man. I was really happy to send you that for a blurb. I was really happy to.
It's great. I'm working my way through it. I'm reading it on the iPad, and when I get a chance, I'm getting through it. I'm loving it. It's a great setup.
Take your time, man. You know, the deal with that stuff is like, I'm waiting for copy editors, you know. These guys, they got to send back. They sent me back the first round of copy edits, and, I mean, holy shit. Like, I had to learn. I'm not a very collegiate guy. You know, I graduated high school and everything, but I'm seeing these copy editing symbols for the first time. I had to look them all up, see what the fuck they all meant.
I know. It was it's like fucking hieroglyphics.
Yeah, it really is.
It's like some secret code. Where's the code for this is shit? I've seen that one all the time. Oh, man. It's brutal.
Hey, man, I was happy.
I didn't even know what they
every
were.
Time.
Hey.
Every time I see something crossed out.
It's only making it better, hopefully.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I started that book. That book originally was 120,000 words, and through the drafts, it's got to be down around, right around 80,000. And just every time I see a line crossed out, every time I see a word crossed out, I get happy as fuck. You know, that's
Hey. That's all right. 80,000 words is solid. Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, I have so much fun on Twitter. I mean, if you get good at Twitter with brevity, well, you know a thing or two about brevity. Right,
well,
short, to the point. I mean, the better you get at that, the better you are at writing.
Yeah, but it's the short attention span, you know. I mean, I wish I could do more on the long stuff, but I've got a baby and I got the wife and I got the dog and I got little time. It's sort of if you've got 10 minutes to fit some writing in, you do what you can do. So the short form is it works really well for me.
Well, the thing is, when it's working well, it's working good, right?
Don't mess with it, right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. So, hey, man, I'm going to be coming out there to, it's probably unrealistic for both you guys, but I'll be out in Oakland July 4th weekend, just throwing it out there if you guys are you guys looking for something to do up in Northern California, there's going to be a
Any excuse to go up the Bay Area, man. I'll take
it. Oh, yeah. I haven't been to the Bay Area in, since, God, probably 5-6 years.
Yeah. Well, I'll hit both you guys up because maybe you're in the mood for coming up there. I think there might be some slots open on the readings that are happening up there. It's going to be a wild time, man. Paul Corman Robbins throws a big-ass party up there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we definitely try and swing something.
Yeah,
well, listen, I have to get out of here. The baby is starting to make the signal that she wants more food. So,
all right, man. Thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and you guys take care. You're doing a great job, and keep the writing going.
I will.
Take care, James.
I will.
All right, take care. See you, Matt. Take care.
That was James Claffey, everybody. The wonderful Dubliner, James Claffey, my Irish friend who lives on an avocado farm. You hear that, Ray? I have a friend who lives on an avocado farm. You were wrong. Ah, shit. So, Matt, what else is going on tonight? Anything good?
No, just pretty much the usual. Like I said, I mean, I just finished up a story that's probably one of the longer ones I've ever written, so I got to kind of figure out exactly where that goes or if I just slash and hack.
Yeah, what's it called?
Find a home for it. What's that?
What's it called?
It's called Float. Well,
yeah,
at least it is right now at this kind of first draft of it. So we'll see. But I'm pretty happy about it. I mean, it's the first time I've tried writing from a female perspective. So
oh, yeah, that's always cool.
Who knows how that's going to be. Yeah, but it seems pretty good. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, in New Jersey, you know? And,
yeah.
You know, some of the guys I work with, they're all cool dudes, but, you know, they don't read. You know, they're not readers. Just obviously, that's fine. I mean, I'm barely a reader myself. But one of the guys was like, hey, I read one of your stories and kind of confused me because it was from the point of view of a girl. What's up with that? And I was like, oh, well, I also have stories from the point of view of dogs and shit. So, you know. I'm not really secretly a woman, you know. It's all fucking funny, man.
Yeah, exactly.
And funny shit. So, actually, I think I'm going to read a story to close the show out. Something I was fucking around with. I never read stories on this show, and I think I'm going to for the first time ever. Usually I have everybody come on here, I have them read stuff, and tonight I'm going to read something myself. So, you in the mood to hear a story, Matt, or you got to go?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'll hang on for it. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, buddy. All right, man, this one is called The Bag of Chips. The day we became eligible for food stamps, we decided to have an early birthday party for Callie. Hand in hand, we walked out of the trailer park down the side of the highway through the wild sage, dust, and litter as cars whizzed by. At the Food Universe, Bonnie loaded our cart with store brand spaghetti, sauce, hamburger helper, store brand soda, orange, wild cherry, grape, not to mention cake mix and confetti frosting. I paid out of pocket for candles, balloons, a couple of new coloring books. An imitation Barbie doll called a Becky doll, who was taller, had a better body, some accessories. In the meat aisle, look at those steaks, I said, drooling. You can look, but you better not touch, she joked. Past the beer aisle, I averted my gaze. She averted her eyes from the mascara, the junk tabloid magazines, the Jesus, everything. Bonnie was embarrassed, but we pushed the shopping cart down the side of the highway anyway. She hid her face with her hands all the way back to the trailer park. I said, baby, I'm sorry. I'm going to fix the Trans Am somehow. You'll never have to do this again. I'd walk with you anywhere, though, she said. Just please don't let anyone honk. I'll die. Home. The afternoon went quick. I cleaned up the junk around the house and front yard while she baked the cake, humming, smiling, peeking at me out the window. I kept glancing at my Casio. Callie's dad, Kenny, was going to come by at noon. I wasn't looking forward to seeing him. We'd had many fistfights over the years. I was missing a front tooth because of him. He walked with a limp because of me. In the house, I tore open a bag of chips, dumped them into a large party bowl. I couldn't believe what I saw. I had to call Bonnie into the dining room. "Look at this," I shouted. "What?" she said, licking cake frosting out of the corner of her mouth. "Tell me this potato chip doesn't look exactly like Elvis Presley." "Oh, wow, it really does," she said. Bonnie took the chip out of the bowl, opened her mouth, and bit off Elvis's head. "What the hell is wrong with you?" "I hate his music." "Hate has nothing to do with it," I said, but caught myself. I almost called her stupid. That wouldn't have been wise. She'd kick my ass. In she reached for another chip. "This one looks like Elizabeth Taylor." I took the chip from her as she jokingly tried to munch off a shoulder. Potato chip Elizabeth Taylor's legs broke off. "Damn it," I said. I snatched up the entire bag of chips. I moved away from her in the trailer. "Hey, bring those back," she said, frowning. "The girls will be here in 10 minutes. I looked in the bag. There was John Lennon, or Jesus, I couldn't be sure. There was Bette Midler. There was whatever the chick's name from Seinfeld was, Elaine. I wouldn't give her the bag of chips. She got angrier and angrier. I said, "Put out the cheese poofs. Put out the pretzels. You're not getting these chips." "But they're Callie's favorite." "No," I said flatly. Bonnie was hot. She threw a plastic cup at me. I guarded the bag. "Don't break any more, you maniac." I backed out of the trailer, laughing and dodging plastic cups as motherfucking Kenny pulled up in the driveway. Callie ran out, hugging my leg. "Hi, Mark." "Well, hello. Happy birthday." Kenny gave me the finger behind the wheel of his pickup truck. The balloons tied to the mailbox shook in terror. "Chips," Callie said. I was trying to hide the bag behind my back. Kenny started to pull out of the driveway, but I motioned for him to wait. "What?" he shouted out the window. "What do you want, you little fuck?" I walked over. "Hey, give me a ride." "A ride to where, the hospital? Or do you want to skip that and go straight to the morgue?" "The library," I said. "Take your bitchmobile," Kenny said, meaning my Trans Am. It was purple, but it wouldn't be for long. I'd paint it if I could get it running. It wasn't a bitchmobile, though. Trans Am is out of commish," I said. "What happened?" he asked. "Engine blew up." "Well, your face is about to blow up from my fist." He kissed his hand. "This bad boy is like a nuclear bomb, you know that." I reached in my pocket, I pulled out a $5 bill. "Give me a lift," I said. He snatched the money out of my hand. As I climbed in the side door of the truck, Bonnie was standing on the porch. "Where the hell are you going?" "The library," I said. "The library?" Four little girls came running past the pickup to the steps of the trailer. "Come back with those chips, you weirdo," I said. "I'm sorry, baby. I'll be back. 2 hours. If you're going out to get messed up, don't come back." "Library," I said again. As soon as we pulled out, Kenny said, "So first of all, what's with the bag of chips?" "Nothing," I said, staring straight ahead. But in truth, I was nervous as hell that he was going to insist on being given a handful. The fuck? We drove to town. He said, "That bitch gets dumber and meaner every year, you know?" "Did you too?" I asked. "Ah, shit, maybe," he admitted. We were silent for the rest of the ride. At the library, he let me out. "You sure you don't want to go get fucked up? I know a guy sitting on some." "I'm sitting pretty," I said, as I walked inside. The girl at the information table said, "No food allowed in the library." "This isn't food," I said. "It's a bag full of money." I sat down on one of the public computers and loaded up eBay. I still had my account for when I sold all my old NASCAR assets. Bonnie didn't realize it yet, but I'd snagged her digital camera, a Christmas gift from her rich bitch sister in Cherry Hill. I set a random chip on the table. It looked like John Candy, no mistaking it. Trains, Planes, and Automobiles, John Candy. Vintage, classic era John Candy. I snapped a photo. It looked better with the flash off. That alone sold for $285. There was a bidding war. No one wanted to back down. When I came back to the trailer, it was long past dark. Callie and Bonnie were asleep on the living room couch. There was still one slice of cake for me on the kitchen table. I had a set of keys for Bonnie. We both have cars. I'd paint mine black as the night and do burnouts in the parking lot of Kenny's motel, waking his ass up at all hours of the night. Her car had air conditioning and a CD player. And that's the bag of chips. So I want to thank all the callers tonight. Matt, thanks for hanging out. Thanks for plugging your new anthology, the Drunk Bug Monkeys Anthology. Now, what is that? Is that right now, is that available as print? As a not
no,
just,
right now
it's
just an ebook. Yeah, just on Amazon. And you can find it on the site. We've got a little post about it, so you can find our Facebook page, or just type
uh-huh.
Drunk Monkeys Anthology into Amazon, you'll find it. So.
Well, that's great.
Well,
I hope everybody checks that out.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for calling in. And in that anthology, again, you can check out Meat Towers, the story of the abortion party. Okay. So, again, everybody, thanks for listening, and I hope you have a nice night.